Okay, everybody. I think I have the technology in control. Maybe not yet. Okay. That's probably pretty good. So y'all can hear me. But if you have to carry on a conversation, now's a good time to go out in the hallway. Okay, I know it's fun to see all your friends and things like that. But I do want everybody to be able to hear me. So you gotta just stop talking. Ladies, please. All right, because we want to carry on with class. So nobody sent me an email saying that they don't want the lectures published online, so I'll start building the web page and uploading lectures because I am recording. And, oh, so this is Bio 231 anatomy lecture, and it's September 4th. And here's the sign-in sheet. So just sign the sign-in sheet when it comes around because that is your receipt that you were in class. So make sure you sign. If you don't sign, then you're not in class, because I can't tell who's in class or not. And we got a few too many lights on, so let me turn some of these lights off. That's good, that's good. How's that? Is that good? Okay. All right, so let's look at the schedule. So today is the 4th. We're going to move on to tissues today. That's chapter 4, but we got to finish up a couple of things in cells before we get there. And then on Monday of next week, we've got a lecture to finish up tissues, and then integumentary system on Wednesday. Then we just get a free lecture on skeletal tissue. Oh, that is on the first exam. No, that's an important lecture on Monday. And then on Wednesday, okay, we do have our first lecture exam. All right, so be prepared. September 18th, exam 1, covering chapters 1 through 6, but we don't cover 3. All right, so it's 1, 2, 4, 5, and 6 for your first exam. Okay, anybody have a question on the schedule? All right, what I want to see in lab from everybody are your filled out weekly study plan. Because I noticed today in lab some people had eyes like they were looking into headlights. Okay, and that's because we cover a lot of material in this class, and you gotta really prepare before lecture, do the pre-lecture reading assignment, study the lab manuals, and so you got to get at least 13 hours of outside class time study in, all right, so that you become familiar with the material. And now is a good time to work on that schedule because it's really hard to catch up in this particular class. All right, so show me your weekly study plan. And if you want to show me your pre-lecture reading assignments, that would be great too, because that's what helps you a lot in lectures. Okay, anybody have a question on the study plan, pre-lecture assignments, where to find a key for the pre-lecture reading assignment and questions? Okay, and the weekly study guide. All of those are in Blackboard. All right, so let's finish up chapter 2. We got down to talking about all the different structures that make up the cell, including these. Oh, you know what? We didn't cover all these nuclear structures, so let me see if I can find those someplace. I talked about them in lab just a little bit. Okay, so this is a good place right here to start. So here is an organelle we call the nucleus. There is a double membrane around it. We call that the nuclear envelope or nuclear membrane. And this membrane pretty much is like any other membrane in your body. What is the simplest way to think of a membrane? Anybody remember the simplest description? It's made out of one kind of compound, which is a phospholipid. And that phospholipid is arranged in two layers. So the easiest, simplest explanation of a membrane is a phospholipid bilayer. Phospholipid bilayer. But all membranes have other things attached to them to give that membrane a special function. So the phospholipid bilayer is really incomplete. It's an incomplete understanding of a plasma membrane. And the best description is the fluid mosaic model. It's fluid because the phospholipid layers are very fluid, but it's also a mosaic because there are other kinds of proteins that are inserted into a membrane to give that membrane a special kind of function. And here I see some proteins inserted into the membrane of this nuclear envelope, and these proteins make a pore, make a passageway from the nucleoplasm out to the cytoplasm. And many elements, like messenger RNA, leaves, or different kinds of RNA leave the nucleus to go into the cytoplasm to be used. right? So I see the nuclear envelope. I see the nucleus, and pretty much it looks all homogeneous. It looks pretty much like all the same color. I don't see any chromosomes in the nucleus. So the phase of the cell cycle that this cell is in is what? Can anybody tell me what phase of the cell cycle is this? Okay, and I heard interphase. Yeah, this is interphase. The cell is not dividing. It's in a growth phase, and the DNA is being used. And so the DNA is a long, stringy molecule, and I think we can see that on the next slide. Here is that long, stringy molecule, and if we were to take all of these strings from your cells and string them from end to end, that string, sew them together. So here's just another example of one little part of a chromosome. If we were to string it out, it would be about 250,000 miles, which is the distance between the Earth and the Moon. That's how much information is contained in all the cells of our body. So when DNA is used, it's pulled off of these proteins right here. We call that extended chromatin. So here is chromatin coming off of a chromosome. It's in an extended form, and it can be used to help make protein, to help run the cell, repair different structures inside the cell, make things that go into the plasma membrane to give that plasma membrane specific functions. But when the cell undergoes cell division, ooh, who knows what that's called? Mitosis. Anybody know the phases of mitosis? Say them out loud, starting with the first one. Prophase, metaphase, second one. Anaphase, and then lastly, and this the word actually means the last thing, and that is telophase. Okay. So when mitosis begins, the nuclear envelope disappears, and so it means that these long, stringy, extended chromatins can be damaged very easily. And then that information is lost, and that is the blueprint on how to make your cell. So then the cell doesn't know how to make itself or repair itself. And since it makes the structures that go inside the cell, what else is the nucleus determining? If it determines the structure, it also determines the function. So the nucleus controls the structure as well as the function inside the cell. And you can't lose that information, otherwise the cell dies. So when a cell goes into mitosis, this DNA has to be protected. And the protected form I see right here. This is what we call condensed chromatin. It's packaged into a chromosome. It can't be used by the cell, but at least it's in a safe condition so that the nuclear envelope can disappear. And the way it gets into the safe condition is that there are some proteins called histones that the extended chromatin gets wound around that I see right here. All right, so these eight little histones form a little packet that we call a nucleosome. And so DNA gets wound around a histone, and then it's wound around a nucleosome, and then it's even wound some more. So that's a way of packaging a very long molecule into a small package, right? It's like folded up by these special kind of windings, and then these windings have windings, right? And then these windings have more windings. So everything is all wound up to make really tight condensed chromatin, right, that makes up a chromosome right here. All right, so that's the difference between DNA strand, okay, that is in a condensed form as compared to an extended form. Histone proteins are these things that help make up a chromosome. And a DNA strand, let's go back maybe one, right here. Here's a zoomed in region of a DNA strand. The building blocks of DNA are what we call nucleotides. And there's only four kinds of nucleotides. And I probably won't even test you on that unless I have a question at the end of back of the chapter or online. All right, here are the nucleotides. There's adenine, thymine, cytosine, and guanine. And these things kind of make a ladder that's twisted. So it kind of looks like a spiral staircase going up. So there's two strands for every DNA molecule. Okay, so those are some nuclear things. All right, when we talked about organelles, the first thing we talked about was membranes. Like, for instance, the nuclear membrane. Where is that at? Right here, nuclear membrane right here, and plasma membrane. And things have to be able to move across these membranes, Right? It has, the cell should be able to get rid of things that it doesn't need or things that are toxic, and it should be able to move things into the cell that it needs, like to make energy, like to make ATP. All right, so there are generally two ways that a cell can move things across a membrane. And again, what's the simplest way that we can think of a cell membrane or any kind of membrane? The simplest form. Phospholipid bilayer. That's right. So it's made out of something that's a lipid. And what can you tell me about lipids or a fat and water? Have you ever run into? They do not mix. That's right. That's really an important consideration. Like this morning, I was making some toast, and I put some butter on it, and it slipped out of my hand. And when you make toast with butter on it, how does it always fall? It seems. Maybe it doesn't always. Maybe it's 50-50. But it always seems like it falls butter down, right? And it fell right on my pants. So now I have some butter on my pants, right? So can I go just get a wet paper towel with water and get that butter off my pants? There's no way, right? Because water and fat just don't mix. That's an important consideration when we think of membranes. Okay. So the two ways that a membrane can transport material across it, it can sometimes happen without energy. We call that passive transport. It's just something that happens automatically. Okay, and since the membrane is made out of fat, anything that's fat soluble, right, can move across the membrane without any trouble whatsoever. Right, so things can move, anything that's fat soluble can move without energy. Other things that can dissolve in water can't dissolve in the plasma membrane. And so that requires other kinds of things. And those other kinds of things usually are what we call active transport. It requires energy. And the energy in our body is ATP. So some membrane transport processes require ATP, and ATP then is broken down into two smaller molecules. That T in ATP stands for triphosphate, so there are three phosphates on this molecule. ADP, how many phosphates are there on ADP? Two, because that D stands for two, diphosphate. And then here is just a single phosphate sitting all out by itself. When that bond is broken, it releases energy for all kinds of things, like for nerve impulses, muscle contraction, but also to move things across a membrane. All right, so if ATP is used, we're going to call that what kind of transport? Active, because it's requiring energy, it's using up energy. Things that happen all by themselves without energy is what we're going to call passive. Okay, two kinds of passive motion across a membrane. One is diffusion and the other is osmosis. And the way things move by diffusion is only by a concentration difference from high to low. Things will always move from high to low if it's diffusion, not from low to high. A good example of that, maybe I have a perfume bottle right here and I open it up and there's no perfume in the room, and the perfume starts to evaporate and form around the bottle, jumps out of the bottle as a little vapor, okay? And there's no perfume in the back, a lot of perfume in the air in the front. Is that perfume going to move to the back of the room? High concentration here, low in the back. It's just automatically going to diffuse back there, even though we don't have a fan plugged in, there's no air motion whatsoever. That perfume is going to move by diffusion. People in the front row will smell it first, then the second row, then third row, and then people all the way in the back. And then when we leave tonight and lock the door up and leave the perfume bottle open all night long, eventually the back of the room will have the same concentration as the front of the room, and then what happens to diffusion when the concentration is the same? It stops. There's no concentration gradient. So diffusion works only when there's a difference in concentration between two different areas. That's what we mean by diffusion. And how does it always have to go? From high concentration to low concentration. It always works just that way. Osmosis is just a special case of diffusion, which means what? Is it active or passive? Is osmosis active or passive? It's passive. Does not require energy. And since it's just a special case of diffusion, that means something is going to move from high concentration to low. And the other characteristic or criteria for osmosis is that it has to be a water molecule, a solvent molecule, and in our biology, that's going to be water. So osmosis is always going to be water moving from high concentration to low. And the last criteria is that it has to go through a membrane. And it's a special kind of membrane. It's a membrane that allows some things to move through, but not everything. Right? And we call that a semi-permeable or selectively permeable membrane. And if you have all of those things, then we know it's osmosis. So what are the things that is required to be osmosis? It has to be the water molecule that's moving. It's got to be moving through a semi-permeable membrane. Okay, and it can only, water can only go from high concentration to low, which by definition means diffusion. Right, so it's diffusion of water across a semi-permeable membrane in one sentence. Okay, but break it down into those three parts. Okay, so your book has a pretty good slide of some of this stuff. Where is it at? Right here. Okay, so here I see the phospholipid bilayer. Okay, you've seen that before. And here is the middle example right here, is we see water on either side of the membrane. And I see 5 water molecules above the membrane. I only see 3 below the membrane, right? Is that a concentration gradient? And I say yes, because I don't see the same number of water molecules on either side. And since above the membrane is a higher concentration of water, these water molecules will want to get inside what we label the cytoplasm, inside the cell. This area up over here is what we call the extracellular fluid that's outside the cell. So water will be able to move across this membrane for certain kinds of cells. And when it does, when water moves by diffusion across this selectively permeable membrane, what are we going to call that? That's osmosis. Okay. The question, yeah?
But the bilayer is lipid, so...
That's right.
Doesn't it?
Water can't get through most cells.
Most cells,
there has to be a channel or a pore right here.
So when you're talking about osmosis, it's only through certain channels.
It's only through certain channels. That's right. So you have to actually refer to the fluid mosaic model to really understand that. And some cells, for instance, like in your kidney, sometimes those channels are open. You will produce just a little bit of urine. Sometimes they're closed and you produce a lot of urine. And when we get to the kidney, that will be intuitive for you. It seems like if the channels are open, you'd produce a lot of urine, but it doesn't really work that way. Okay. When we get to kidney, we'll talk about that. Those channels, they're called aquaporins. They open and close. Some cells, like red blood cells, have them all the time, right? And so water can move across a red blood cell membrane very easily because they have those special channels. Here I see a channel, like for instance, for water to move across. Right. If it's a lipid-soluble molecule, it doesn't need a channel or a special kind of protein in the membrane. It can just diffuse across because the inner part of this membrane is a lipid. I don't even think I want to give you some examples of, well, carbon dioxide can dissolve in lipids. So carbon dioxide can move freely across this membrane. And a cell, when it makes ATP, makes carbon dioxide. Carbon dioxide in the air is almost zero in concentration. It's high in your body, and it can move across membranes. What do we call that process when something can go from a high concentration to low concentration without requiring any ATP, like carbon dioxide?
Passive.
It's passive. So we excrete carbon dioxide passively because it's almost zero concentration in the air. And so it's dying to leave our body, to get out of our body. If concentration of CO2 was high in the room, guess what? Then CO2 would build up in our body. We couldn't get rid of it. Okay, so it's a good thing there's very little CO2 in the air that we're breathing or surrounded by. All right, so here's simple diffusion. And if it's the water molecule through a selectively permeable membrane, we call that osmosis. But there are many kinds of solutes that are dissolvable in water, for instance, like sugar, glucose, for instance. If you have some coffee or tea and you put sugar in there, does it dissolve? Very easily. It's very water soluble, which means that it cannot go across the membrane all by itself. It requires, okay, some kind of carrier protein or protein inside the membrane. And a lot of times, water-soluble solutes or particles move from one side or the other because it requires ATP. If it requires ATP, it's active transport. If it does not require ATP, if it just moves from high to low, then we call it, these are examples of just simple diffusion or passive, actually passive diffusion. All right, so this is active transport here, passive diffusion. Here is an example. You see ATP being used by this channel through the membrane. I see it here, but I don't see it here. What about the concentration? I see four solutes here or particles. I see one here. Where is it, the concentration high? Extracellular fluid or cytoplasm? Extracellular fluid. So when something moves from high concentration to low, that's just passive diffusion, right? That's diffusion. Not osmosis, because this particle is not water. I see water over here. All right, but this is a water-soluble substance, maybe like a salt, for instance. It can only go across the membrane when this channel is open. Another form of active transport, okay, these are just the pictures we looked at. Sometimes there are very large particles that would never fit through a pore or a channel in a membrane, and the cell actually has to engulf them, has to surround them. So here's the plasma membrane. Here's a large particle, and it can't fit through any pores in the membrane, so the cell surrounds it with the plasma membrane, right, and surrounds it more and more and more, and finally it forms a complete vesicle around this particle, and that vesicle separates from the plasma membrane, and now it's floating inside the cell with all of this extracellular material inside the vesicle. That's another way of making things go across this plasma membrane, because this stuff is now inside the cell. And to move the membrane around like this, that just doesn't happen automatically. That requires energy in the form of ATP. So this form that we call phagocytosis, when a cell is actually eating a solid particle, that is a form of, what would you say, since it requires ATP? Passive or active? Active, that's active transport. Okay, so phagocytosis is when the cell takes in solid particles. When it brings in liquid like water, we call that pinocytosis. Pinocytosis, right, and phagocytosis are bringing particles inside the cell. Okay, so phagocytosis, pinocytosis. The reverse of these processes is moving something outside the cell. So this arrow actually could be going in two directions. This vesicle could bind to the plasma membrane, and then whatever inside the vesicle is released into the extracellular fluid, and we call that exocytosis. And is exocytosis passive or active? It's active. Requires ATP to move this vesicle around to get it to fuse to the membrane right here. Okay. So that's a form of active transport. And indeed, right, we have seen exocytosis before in the form of a secretory pathway. And here is a good example of a secretory pathway where a protein is made in the rough ER. Right, and it gets packaged into a vesicle that moves over to the Golgi apparatus. That protein is then modified. Maybe a sugar is added to it. Maybe it's broken into pieces, or maybe a lipid is added to it. Right? And then it's packaged in another vesicle, and that vesicle is moved over to the plasma membrane, and then that protein that's modified is secreted from the cell. So secretion is an active transport process, and we call that exocytosis. Right? So that's the reverse of phagocytosis. Okay, so that's pretty good for movement across the plasma membrane. Right, and that's really key for physiology. So just try to really understand the difference between active and passive motion across the cell membrane. And some things require channels or pores. Sometimes those channels are open, sometimes they're closed, and it's the job of a cell to regulate that. Okay, one important class of molecules in our body, a biological molecule, is a protein. And probably most of you have heard what the building block of a protein is without really knowing much about it, but you've kind of heard. Does anybody know what the building block of a protein is? It's an amino acid, that's right. And there are about 20 commonly occurring amino acids, and a protein might need all of them, or a protein might need just a couple of them, but the way that they are added to make a protein, okay, is very specific. They can only go in a certain order. Just like if you want to spell a word, can you put the letters of that word in any order that you want in order to spell that word out? Nope. It's got to, in order for that word to have meaning, the letters have to be arranged in a line in a certain order for that word to make sense. Same thing for a protein. The amino acids have to be in a certain order in order to make that particular shape for that protein. And if it has the right shape, guess what it has? The right function. If it ends up with the wrong shape, then it loses its function and can't work for you inside your cell. So it's real important to be able to build proteins from those building blocks in the right sequence so that these words or proteins are spelled out with the correct spelling. All right, and this is how it's done. Protein synthesis. All right, here's a good place to start. We call this the central dogma in biology. A dogma is something that you should never question, should never alter from. Okay, but as far as science goes, what do you know about science? You should always question everything, right? You should always challenge ideas, right? Because a lot of ideas are incomplete and they should be understood to a better degree. So this dogma right here is a very early understanding of what we know about protein synthesis. And in some respects it's wrong, but this is a good place to start to understand what protein synthesis is all about and how it occurs. Okay, so I see how many different kinds of molecules right here on this line? How many do you see? How many different kinds of molecules? I see an RNA. Is RNA different than DNA? Absolutely, because one has a D and the other has an R. Okay, is RNA different than protein? Absolutely, because protein has a P and RNA has an R. All right, so here are three different kinds of molecules inside your body, and they're converted from one to another. And how many steps does it take to convert information in DNA into a protein? I see two arrows, so it means that there are two steps. Right, so there are two steps in protein synthesis. And the central dogma of biology says that the information flows in this direction. Information is contained in DNA. DNA makes chromosomes, and you know that's in your nucleus. So the information in DNA flows into RNA, which is a similar kind of molecule. And then that information is used to make a protein, which is a much different kind of molecule. So information always flows, DNA to RNA to protein. And that's really handy. Because, for instance, tonight when you go home and have a chicken dinner from the barbecue or something, you're eating a lot of chicken proteins, you don't have to worry about waking up in the morning with a beak, right? Because information doesn't flow from those proteins into DNA inside your cells. You'll never end up looking like a chicken, right? And you all kind of know that already. So that's why you see these arrows going only in one direction. All right, so we see it a two-step process. This first step right here. DNA and RNA, you can see, because I see an NA here and an NA here, they're very similar kinds of molecules. They are only different by the kind of one little piece that's in them, a sugar molecule. This is a deoxyribose. This is just a regular ribose. Deoxy means that it's missing just one oxygen atom. So there's hardly any difference, right? They're almost exactly the same molecule. So let's just say I have your grades on a sheet of paper right here, and I want another copy of it, or you want another copy of it. What are you going to do with it, with that piece of paper, so that you can have another copy? Maybe you need 100 copies. Maybe you're applying for 100 jobs someplace. What are you going to do with that piece of paper? At least 10 years ago, you would photocopy it, right? And the photocopy is going to be, what, an exact copy? Pretty doggone close. It might have some little, you know, dust particles here and there, but it's going to be an exact copy. All right, and so what do we call that when you make an exact copy? As a matter of fact, when you call, maybe you don't have a record of your grades on a piece of paper, but you want to get one, and you're going to call admission and records, and what will you ask for? A transcript, and a transcript is just what? It's just a photocopy of your grades that are over there. So when you're making an exact duplicate copy, we call that transcription. Right, and transcription is this first step. So this on top of this first arrow, you could say transcription. Transcription is converting information from DNA to RNA. And where is DNA located? in the nucleus. So transcription always happens inside the nucleus. So it's important for you guys to know where it takes place, what it's called, and how information is, with the names of that, those different forms of information, right? So it occurs in the nucleus, never in the cytoplasm, right? So DNA can never leave the nucleus, otherwise it gets damaged. So we make a photocopy of it, and a photocopy is RNA. The RNA is shipped into the cytoplasm, right, to do its job, to make a protein. But if that RNA gets damaged, does the cell die? No, because that information is still there in the nucleus in the form of DNA. So the cell just makes some more RNA, right? So you lose your transcript, or your dog eats it, or you get butter all over that transcript before you send it out. What can you do? Call Mission and Records again and say, hey, I need another transcript. The cell can do that same thing. It can call for more RNA because the information is never lost. It's in the nuclear, behind the nuclear membrane. Okay, a couple different kinds of RNA. There is a messenger RNA, and remember we said there are four nucleotides that make up DNA. Those nucleotides are in a special order that will determine the special order, and we call that the sequence, the special of amino, the order of amino acids that are added to make a protein that has a specific sequence. We call that the messenger RNA. The other kind of RNA, is what we call transfer RNA, or tRNA. So in order to make a protein, what kind of building blocks do you need once again? You need amino acids. So this transfer RNA is a special kind of RNA that's wandering everywhere inside the cell through the cytoplasm, and it's going to grab onto an amino acid, right? And then it's going to bring it to the workbench where proteins are made. Proteins are made in the cytoplasm. Right, so when you make something, you need all the pieces, the building blocks. The transfer RNA is like a taxi RNA. It brings amino acids over to the workbench, and the workbench is made mostly out of rRNA. And that R stands for ribosomal RNA. And guess what? You knew that already. You knew what organelle inside that cell makes proteins. And you know that to be a ribosome, right? So a ribosome is that workbench that gets amino acids from the transfer RNA or that taxi RNA. It knows how to put the amino acids together in the right way to spell that protein out perfectly because that's contained in the messenger RNA. So messenger RNA, right, gets to the workbench or a ribosome, taxi RNAs bring it over, and that protein is made right there on a ribosome. And remember, there's two kinds of ribosomes. Whether that protein is going to end up outside the cell or in the cytoplasm, right? It has to do whether that ribosome is attached to rough endoplasmic reticulum or not. Okay, so the information on how to build a protein is contained in something that we call a gene. A gene is just a segment of a chromosome that has the right order to spell out that particular protein. It has the right order of nucleotides to spell out that protein. And then it's transcribed into RNA that goes into the cytoplasm where it's used to make a protein. All right, so we're done talking about this first arrow. So that's just one step, but we know how many steps are there to make a protein. There are two. So we've got to talk about this second arrow right here. All right, so RNA is a very similar language to DNA. We said it's only different by one atom out of many, 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 many. I should actually know the number. Let's just say 100, okay? And so the language of RNA is pretty much identical to the language of DNA. The building blocks are nucleotides. But what is the building block of a protein? Amino acid. Totally different kind of molecule. Radically different. The language is totally different in a protein compared to RNA. All right? But the information is going to be the same. It's just going to be the sequence of nucleotides and RNA corresponding to the sequence of amino acids in a protein. The information is still the same, but the language is different. What do you call that process where you take information in one language and convert it into another language, but you don't change the information at all? That's translation. Yeah, so if you're speaking in Farsi and you want to talk to somebody in French, then you need a translator to do that, unless you know both languages, and then translation is happening inside your mind, right? So translation is a process of taking information in one language, converting it into another. Okay, so translation is the conversion of RNA into a protein. That happens in the cytoplasm, because RNA can go into the cytoplasm. Cytoplasm has amino acids. Cytoplasm has ribosomes, all the things necessary to make a protein, and that's what we call translation. The second step in protein synthesis is translation. Okay, so that protein synthesis, kind of like a synopsis of it, how it kind of works, the two main steps. Cell division, we've talked about a lot in lab. Okay, I don't see drawings right here, but we could have a daughter cell and a daughter cell here. What's the difference between these daughter cells? Absolutely nothing. What's the difference between a daughter cell and this parent cell? Same cell, over and over again. 46 chromosomes in this parent cell, 46 in each of these daughter cells. Because remember, a chromosome before mitosis replicates itself. And actually, you have two chromosomes joined together, and we just call that one chromosome. There's two chromosomes that are identical, joined together, and it kind of forms that little X pattern. And I don't think I even want to find that picture to show you, but you're aware of that. All right, so the separation of genetic material is what we call mitosis. We know the phases for that. But the separation of the cytoplasm into two separate cells, what do we call that? That is cytokinesis, right? And cytokinesis is a process that in this class occurs during telophase, which is the last phase, right? So that's a good definition. So what is cytokinesis? It's the separation of cytoplasm, which is cytosol, and organelles together into two separate daughter cells. But if you're just going to think about genetic material, then you're going to think about mitosis. That's the proper term for that. All right, so, and cytokinesis is just something that happens within mitosis to make it work properly. Okay, well, you're going to have to look over this two-step process for making a protein. You might have to think about these processes for membrane transport, active versus passive, for a little while. All right, before you come up with some good questions. But maybe you're kind of familiar with this and you have some good questions already, or maybe some not so good questions. So at least in your mind, you might think they're not so good questions. In my mind, they might be an excellent question. So does anybody have any questions regarding these last two topics in this chapter right here? Protein synthesis, transport, and then mitosis. Probably you had a lot of chances to talk to me about mitosis already. Okay. I see no hands. So that means we're going to move on to the next chapter. And so that was chapter 2. We're going to skip chapter 3 and move on to chapter 4, which is histology. Histology is the study of cells, and cells make up tissue. So we're going to look at different tissues inside your body. Okay. So let me put this away over here. Label, let's go back to chapter 4. Thank goodness I have it labeled. Okay, that's nice. Okay, some people that have had lab this morning are sort of familiar with what we're going to talk about today, but we have two lecture periods to talk about all this stuff. Okay, so you guys are a little bit ahead of schedule, but those of you that have lab this afternoon will listen to me now and you'll be a little bit ahead of where the morning lab was, because they didn't know anything about tissues when we started. All right, so tissues in your body can be grouped into some main categories, just a few main categories. And on this slide right here, it gives you the four main categories. Can anybody read those categories for me? You got what? Epithelium, connective, muscle, and nervous tissue. Okay, those are the four main kinds of tissue. So if you point anywhere in your body, you or I should be able to tell you which of those four kinds of tissues it is, because there are not a lot of choices. Let me tell you just a little bit. Epithelium covers a surface, for instance, like your skin, or lines a cavity. Maybe it lines your heart or lines your digestive tract. That's an epithelium. Connective, it also makes glands. Epithelium makes glands. Connective tissue is a kind of tissue that connects things together. Like there's a tissue that connects your skin to muscles that are underneath it. Or maybe bone. Maybe you don't have a muscle right there. Maybe you got a bone right there. Okay. So that's a kind of connective tissue, connects different parts of your body. Muscle tissue, right? Anybody can figure out a way to explain what muscle tissue does? What does a muscle do?
Movement.
Yeah, movement I like because of what I really like to think of the function of muscle is because muscle can shorten. It can contract. And if things are attached to either end of the muscle when it contracts, then it causes motion in those two parts of your body. So motion is really the reason why we have muscle, but if you just think of one muscle, it contracts. It can never push. It can only contract. Even though you can push, it's only because some muscle somewhere in your body is contracting, all right? And it works on a lever system so that it actually feels like you're pushing, but it's due to a muscle contracting. Right, and there's three different kinds of muscle. Nervous tissue is the fourth kind, and we're going to see that there's two different kinds of nervous tissue in your body, at least at this introductory chapter. All right, so a tissue is a group of cells. You kind of know that. But those cells are what? They have a similar structure. If they have a similar structure, what else is similar? Function is very similar, but here's something that's not so intuitive. In a tissue, even all the junk between cells is the same. And that stuff between cells is what we call the extracellular material. Extracellular means outside the cell. Intracellular means inside the cell. And extracellular fluid in some tissues is super special, and we give it a special name. I'll tell you what that is when we get to it. Extracellular material. So similar structure, function, and extracellular material. So let's just go to epithelium. Oh, but I see I missed something. A membrane. We use that term a lot in here. That's not a tissue all by itself, but usually it's a combination of two tissues. It's a combination of epithelium and a connective tissue put together to make a membrane. All right, so the first tissue, epithelium. Okay, characteristics we said cover surfaces of the body. Here are some good examples. A blood vessel, okay, has a surface, like the inside of that tube is a surface, and it's covered with an epithelium. Right? Epithelium also makes glands. A nice characteristic of epithelium is that it has very little extracellular material, almost none. So when one cell from an epithelium stops, right there another one begins. The cell membranes are touching each other. So epithelium is made mostly of cells. It has no extracellular space. That's another way of saying it. It has a free edge, a free surface. We call that the apical surface. For instance, your body is covered with an epithelium, and on one edge of your skin there is what? There's nothing there. There's no part of your body. There's just air, right? So that's a characteristic of an epithelium. It has a free surface that is acellular. Doesn't have cells in it. Okay, but it also has a deep layer. We call that the basal surface. And here is something really strange about an epithelium. It never contains a blood vessel, right? There are probably a couple times. Maybe you grabbed a piece of paper or an envelope or something and you got a paper cut, right? And when you get a paper cut, what does it feel like sometimes? Really stings, right? It hurts really bad sometimes. And so you put your finger over it to stop the bleeding, and sometimes you don't even want to look to see how much blood there's going to be because you don't want to see how bad a paper cut it was. And you take your finger away, and what do you see? No blood whatsoever. Right, but it hurt really bad, so you're kind of really let down. You thought, oh wow, that was a really bad injury, and it wasn't really bad at all, but it hurt bad because there are nerves, right, that were cut, but no blood vessels. No blood vessels in epithelium. Okay, so here is an example of an epithelium. We can see we see three cells right here, and there's very little space between them. What else? Here's the free space above the epithelium, so this is the apical surface. Here's the rest of your body down over here, so this is the basal surface, and indeed the basal surface of an epithelium has a membrane. We call that the basement membrane. And since these layers, this layer of cells is covering this surface, we call it an epithelium. Epi means on top of, right? So it's on top of some other structures. And here you can see it could be on top of a blood vessel, it could be on top of this nerve, but nerves do go up into the epithelium right here. Okay, so on this slide, it's important for you to see the apical surface as opposed to the basal surface. One way to think about it, this is the superficial surface. Here is the deep surface. And what can you tell me about these two surfaces? The superficial from the deep. What can you, when you look at this slide, what do you see? Do they look the same? No, there's a difference, right? And cells in your body, there's going to be a difference in how these membranes are made. The kinds of proteins that enter the plasma membrane are different at the apical surface compared to the basal surface. What I see right here are some specializations on some kinds of epithelia. I see cilia on this cell. This is for motility, right? And then I see some microvilli on these cells. And microvilli, does anybody remember what the function of microvilli are? Increased surface area for the purpose of absorption. That's right. So actually, this cell isn't this wide that I'm pointing out. How wide is this cell really? It goes from here to way over here if we were able to stretch out all of these microvilli, right? So it's a much bigger cell. The surface area is much bigger, okay, because of all of these folds that are in the apical surface of that membrane. All right, what about space between the cells? Hardly any at all, right? I don't hardly see any space. So that's a good indication that this is an epithelium. Okay, we want to be able to classify an epithelium, and a real easy way and a good way to do this is by the shape of the cells and also by how many layers there are between the basement membrane and the apical surface of that epithelium. So let's take a look at some different shapes. And there are only three classic kinds of shapes, and then a couple other shapes that are strange that we'll look at. Sometimes they're flat like a pancake. We call that squamous, right? And guess what squamous means? It means flat, right? So any place in your body that has a flat region, we're going to call that the squamous region, like in your head, for instance. That's a squamous region. Some cells are about as wide as they are tall, as they are deep, and they kind of look like a square. We're going to call those cuboidal cells. And then some cells are really tall compared to their width and to their depth, and they look like a column, so we're going to call those columnar cells. So I see three different kinds of epithelia here based on their shape. There could be a squamous epithelium, a cuboidal epithelium, or a columnar epithelium. And then the second way that we have to talk about an epithelium is by number of layers of these type of cells. If there is just one layer of squamous cells, or one layer of cuboidal cells, or one layer of columnar cells. In this example, I see one layer of squamous cells. We call that a simple epithelium, right? But if I just say simple, you don't know if it's squamous, cuboidal, or columnar. So to describe this one right here, you'd have to give me a complete description. So you would use both the shape of the cells and the number of layers. And then you would say it is a simple squamous epithelium, and then I would know, everybody would know exactly what you're talking about, okay? This other one down here, okay, how many layers do you see? Do you see one? Okay, if it's one, it's simple. If it's more than one, if it's two, if it's three, if it's four, if it's maybe 50 layers, then we call it a stratified. So from 2 to 50 or even more, that's a stratified epithelium. Now what about the shape of these cells? They kind of change their shape from the basal surface to the apical surface. We always name the epithelium by the shape of the cells in the apical surface, not the basal surface. So who can tell me the shape of these cells up here on the apical surface of this membrane or this epithelium? Yeah, they're squamous. So this is a stratified squamous epithelium. This one is a simple squamous epithelium, but you could have epithelia with these other cell types. And in lab, your job is to look at some microscope slides that contain these kinds of different kinds of epithelia on them. So let's see if we can find some of these things. Okay, let's look at some of these. Okay. This right here is a nice micrograph of some tubes. And here is a tube that's been cut in a nice perpendicular fashion. So here I have a marker. Okay, I'm just looking at the sign-in sheet. Did I pass the sign-in sheet around already? I think I did. Did I? Who's got the sign-in sheet? Good, you signed already. Good. All right, so here's a tube. It's really a magic marker, but think it's a tube going someplace, carrying material. If I cut a tube with a nice transverse section, we call a cross-section, what is that going to look like if we look at the end of it that we cut? It's going to look like a? Yeah, it's going to look like a, I see a circle. I see a circle right there. Do you see a circle? Ah, here's a nice circle right here. So that's a tube that has been cut in cross-section. But not all tubes are oriented just in that direction. Some of them move like this. And if we cut this marker like that, we end up with what? An oval. And if the tube is going in this direction and we cut it, then we get something that looks really long. So it all depends on the orientation of that tube. Here is an oval. So here's a tube that's on an angle to the plane of the section. Here is something that looks really, really long. So that's a section that has cut the tube from end to end, so it looks long. But nonetheless, we can look inside this tube. All right, so what are we going to look at on these tubes? I see this dark line right here. That's important. Your eye should catch that right away. That's the basement membrane. And that's a characteristic of all epithelia. It has to have a basement membrane. And then here is that free space with nothing in it, but this is probably like a, could be a salivary gland, so there's saliva in there, but there's no part of your body in there. Right, so here is the apical surface. Here's the basal surface. So how many cells do you see from basement membrane to the apical surface? I see one. So this is a simple epithelium, but we have to classify it by the shape of these cells. Not exactly perfect, but okay, here I see one. Okay, here I see one, here I see one, here I see one. What do these look like? These are cuboidal cells. So this is a simple cuboidal epithelium. Right. So the first thing your eye should always pay attention to is this basement membrane and this free surface right here. Count the number of cells, and then you really know something about this particular epithelium. Okay, now what about the space between the cells that make up epithelium right here? You see any space? No space. Cells are packed close together. In between the tubes, we have material that connects the tubes together, and we call that connective tissue. Okay? So in lab, for the lab practicum, I know you don't have microscopes at home. You might have a microscope, but you don't have slides of all these different tissues. Right? So the slides that I will test you on in the practicum are these slides that are in your book. Because somebody looked at maybe 100 slides of a simple cuboidal epithelium, maybe 1,000, and said, oh, this is the best of the best of the best slide that I see. We're going to put this in the textbook, right? So this is a perfect example of a simple cuboidal epithelium. In lab, you're going to see things that are not quite so good because they contain what? They contain artifacts. Yeah, maybe when we made a thin section, maybe the razor blade was a little dull and squished all these cells, so maybe they kind of look squamous or columnar or something like that. But here is like a perfect example. This is a picture that I'll put on the practicum. These lead lines that I see three lead lines. The labels will be erased and I'll have a number right here. I might have a number like question number 45, and it's going to say, name this structure. 45 right here. On your answer sheet, what would you put for question number 45? Basement membrane. Okay, here's 46. What would you put for this one? Connective tissue, right? Don't just memorize the order of words right here because that's easy to forget. Actually look at the picture and see what it's pointing to make sure that it makes sense, right? And if it makes sense, then you're doing really good. Simple cuboidal. All right, now how would we classify this epithelium? Here's that free space with nothing in it. Here's the basement membrane. And what about the shape of these cells? Columnar. Okay, how many layers from basal to apical surface? One. So this is a simple columnar epithelium. The space inside this tube we call the lumen of the tube. So it could be a lumen inside the digestive tract, lumen inside of a blood vessel, right, in the lumen inside of a duct of a salivary gland or sweat gland. Okay, the center piece right here is going to be the lumen of a particular tube. All right, I'm going to come back to that one. Here's one that looks pretty complicated, but let's analyze it. It's not too bad. Here I see some connective tissue. Here I see a basement membrane for an epithelium. Right, so here's the basal surface, here's the apical surface. How many cell layers do you see? One? No, I see a lot. Many. So you would call that stratified. Right, but we also got to name it by its shape. We go to the apical surface to look at the shape of these cells on the apical surface, and these are flat. So it's a stratified squamous epithelium. Looks complicated, but once you analyze it, it's not very bad. But so you see the cells change as they move from the basal part to the apical part. And these cells right here are designed to slough off. These are the cheek cells, actually, that we looked at in lab last week or a week before. Okay, but this is a cross-section. The ones that we looked at were just floating around by themselves. We stained them blue. This has a different kind of stain on them so that they look differently. All right, so stratified squamous epithelium. Here's a tube. Not quite in cross-section, almost in cross-section, but it looks a little oval. Maybe because of the way it's shown on the screen. The screen is stretched a little bit. So what do I see? I see basement membrane right here, apical surface. What do we call the inside of a tube?
Lumen.
The lumen. That's right. So here's the lumen containing sweat, saliva, blood, something like that. Okay. So apical surface, basal surface, how many cells do you see? I see two. So is it simple? Stratified, even though it only has two layers?
Yeah.
Absolutely. Okay. Stratified, and what is the shape of these cells?
Cuboidal.
So here's a stratified cuboidal epithelium. Right. So look at those pictures that are in your book, because these are the ones that will be on the practicum. All right. Nice basement membrane right here. Apical surface. There's that free space. And is this simple or stratified?
Stratified.
And the shape of these cells? Columnar. So a lot of these slides are really easy, kind of trivial to look at. Right? So here's a stratified columnar epithelium lining the urethra, for instance. Okay. Oh, one thing I wanted to say about this basement membrane. You notice that it is labeled on many of the slides, probably most of them. So that's something that your eye should key upon right away. All these slides are from normal tissues. If it's an abnormal tissue, this basement membrane is going to be discontinuous. It's going to have jagged edges. It's going to be missing parts. So this basement membrane, if this was a diseased tissue, wouldn't go like this. Okay, it would dive down, way down into the connective tissue, and then it might disappear altogether. That's a nice indication, for instance, of carcinoma or cancer. Okay, so you should always find this basement membrane. Okay, because that will tell you if that tissue is normal or abnormal. It will also define what the basal region of that epithelium is. Yeah. This one right here, you know, I think that's probably an artifact of preparation. Or there could be some adipocytes in here that didn't pick up any stain. So I don't know if I would really call this a free space or not. You know, if I saw some circular stuff right here, I might think that it's a blood vessel that doesn't have blood in it. And if that was the case, then this would be the lumen of that blood vessel, the free space. And there would be an epithelium lining that blood vessel. But, you know, I just don't see it on this particular slide. But what is interesting, I kind of see right here, right below my little magnifying glass, I see a line. I see another line right here. And that tells me it could be a really thin cell. It could be a squamous cell, and that's exactly the kind of cell that lines a blood vessel, a squamous cell. So I get an idea that it could be a blood vessel because of this cell right here, but I don't see many other characteristics of this being a capillary or a blood vessel. Okay. Okay. So free a lumen is free space, but for instance, the free space above your skin is not lumen. We don't call that free space lumen. Was that your question? I'm not quite sure. Yeah. So the lumen is just the inside of a tube that's carrying stuff. And there's an epithelium that lines that tube. Sometimes if we have a epithelium that lines the inside of something, like a blood vessel, instead of calling it an epithelium, we call it an endothelium, meaning that it's inside something, but nonetheless it still covers a surface. Okay. So endothelium is just a special kind of description for an epithelium. It has those same characteristics, the number of layers and the shape of those cells. Okay. All right, so we talked about shapes. There's one, there's actually two weird kinds of epithelium. Here's that nice basement membrane. Okay, and is it stratified or squamous?
Stratified,
but we never talk about it that way for the following reason. There's only one kind of epithelium that looks like this, and everybody knows it's stratified, so we don't have to say it. But if we look at these cells on the apical surface, to me, they just look like pillows that you'd throw on your couch, right, on your bed or whatever. And these cells right here can change their shape. They can be short and thick, or they can be really long and thin. So this is an epithelium that lines a cavity that changes shape all day long. This organ gets really big, and then it shrinks down. And then it gets big again, and then it shrinks down. So these cells up here have to stretch out when this organ gets big. Anybody have an idea of what we're talking about? What organ?
Bladder.
A urinary bladder. Yeah, so your kidneys are producing urine all day long. Urinary bladder fills up, and then when you void, what happens to the bladder? Shrinks back down. Okay. And so we call this a transitional epithelium, and the only part of your body that has transitional is the urinary bladder. Okay. The last kind of epithelium, here's a basement membrane. Looks pretty complicated again. All right, but let's describe what's going on here. What do these cells look like? So here's the basement membrane, here's the apical surface. What do these cells look like? Columnar. So that's good. That works. All right, but depending on where you look, sometimes it looks like it's one cell layer deep. Sometimes it looks like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 layers deep. All right, and so this is what we call pseudostratified, because it changes depending on where you look on the epithelium. So it's a pseudostratified columnar epithelium. But there's something else that I notice that's really nice. Look at this apical surface. It's covered with cilia. Right? And so we call this a pseudostratified ciliated columnar epithelium because it has all of those characteristics. It has another characteristic. It has this cell right here that kind of looks like an upside down wine glass. Like here's the stem, here's the bowl of that wine glass. That's called a goblet cell. And a goblet cell is producing mucus that it secretes onto the apical surface. And that mucus doesn't stain very well, so these goblet cells look kind of white underneath the microscope. They don't have a lot of color to them. All right, and what's the job of these cilia once again? For motility, they're sweeping. They're all sweeping in one direction. They're sweeping that mucus in one direction. And this is a good example of the epithelium that lines the trachea. The trachea is your windpipe, and that's how air gets into your lungs and how air leaves your lungs. And when you breathe in air, we're breathing in all kinds of dust and junk particles, bacteria, viruses, and dust. And so a lot of that material gets trapped in this mucus on the surface of the trachea. But then the cilia sweep it up, right? And where do they sweep it? Do they sweep it into your lungs or up out of your body? Up and out of your body. Yeah, because if it swept down into your lungs would fill up with mucus filled with bacteria and viruses and things like that. Okay, and then once it's in your mouth, what do? Yeah, you just swallow it down, okay, just like that, and it gets out of your body that way. Unless what? I'm picking on baseball players. Unless you're a baseball player, then you can spit it out, but don't do it here in class, okay? Thank you. Even baseball players can't do it in class, okay? But of course they know that. All right, so this is a pseudostratified ciliated columnar epithelium, and that's all you have to know about epithelium. So these are, okay, the pictures that you'll have for the practicum. Okay, what else do we want to say? Well, since this is lecture, we got to know a little bit more than just pictures. We said that epithelium can form glands. Okay, and there are two kinds of glands. I have it on two different pages right here, but it would be really nice if I just stuck it on one page. So the two general classifications for glands, we'll talk about this through the whole class. It can be an exocrine gland or an endocrine gland. What does exocytosis mean? Outside, secreting outside, right? So an exocrine gland is secreting a material outside of the cell into a duct. And that carries it to some distant location where that product that that cell makes will do its job, like a salivary gland. Secretes saliva deep inside your head, but it goes through a duct and enters your oral cavity, and that's where it does its job. Sweat is produced deep inside your skin, right? but it doesn't get secreted in your skin. It gets secreted where? On top of, and it gets there by a duct. So an exocrine gland always has a duct. Endocrine gland, on the other hand, has a different method of transporting its product around. Right? An endocrine gland secretes its product into just the extracellular space, and then it's absorbed into a capillary by diffusion. And when it's in a capillary, where does it go? A capillary is a type of blood vessel. Where does it go? Everywhere in the body, right? It gets in the blood, and blood goes everywhere in your body, right? And then it can have an effect. There can be a hormone that has that's maybe secreted in the brain, and it has an effect on your little toe, right? And because it hops a ride in your circulatory system. So an endocrine gland has no ducts. It uses the vascular system, and the product that an endocrine gland makes is always what we call a hormone. All right, so what kind of gland secretes a hormone? Endocrine gland. All right, okay. A hormone is not secreted by an exocrine gland. It's a different kind of gland. You've got some pictures of different kinds of exocrine glands. They're not too hard to see. I think you should be really aware of what they look like, so maybe I'll show you just a couple examples. A couple examples that I don't see right here. Ah, here. Okay. All right, so here's a gland. Here are some cells that are making a product and secreting it into this tube right here. Is this an endocrine gland? Exocrine, because there's a tube. So here is just a simple straight tube. So we call that a simple tubular gland. But sometimes glands are a little bit more complicated. It has branches, so we call that a simple branched tubular gland. Right? And that's one kind. Another kind, instead of being a straight tube, sometimes it forms a little sphere, a bowl. Sometimes, and that little spherical structure we call an alveolus. Right? And so sometimes glands have an alveolus on their end, and so we call that a simple alveolar gland, different than the straight tubular. And then here's a simple branched alveolar. And then sometimes some glands have tubes and alveoli on them, and those would be a complex or compound duct structure, like compound alveolar. And if it has tubes and alveolar, here's a compound tubulo-alveolar. Because remember, we can combine terms in anatomy, like a straight tube and alveolus, by doing what? By putting that O between them. So we know that it is made up of those two kinds of tubes. So I think this might be an exam figure. I'm not quite sure. Okay, so remember how to label these things by the type of gland it is. Okay, and on the test I can't make black and white pictures, so I can't test you on what these colors are. I couldn't test you even if it was printed in color. I wouldn't know how to grade it. You could say anything you wanted. Okay, so that's it for glands and epithelium. So that takes us to connective tissue. Almost. Okay, almost, because I do want to go back. Here is an epithelium that makes a gland. And what can you tell me about all of these cells? Are they separated from each other? No, they're packed close together, right? That's a characteristic of epithelium. That is not a characteristic of connective tissue. Well, maybe I'll look at the folder that has this information. Okay. In connective tissue, there's a big space between cells. So here we see an illustration that has every possible component that a connective tissue could have. And a particular connective tissue won't have all of these things. And it might have one or two of these things, maybe three of these things. But I want to talk about all of them together so you get a sense of what a connective tissue is. I see a cell right here, and I see a cell right here, and there's a big space between them. All right? And I see the cell right in the middle, and then I see another cell way down over here with a big space between them. So could this be an epithelium if you were to look at this underneath a microscope? Indeed not, because of that big space. Okay, that big space is really special. That space in a connective tissue is what gives that connective tissue its special properties or separates one kind of connective tissue from another. It's not the type of cell necessarily, it's that space and what fills up that space. There are two kinds of things that fill up that space. It could be a fiber of some kind, Or it could be like a jelly-like material right over here that we call ground substance. So that space is filled up with fibers or ground substance. And is it intracellular or extracellular? It's outside the cell. It makes up that extracellular matrix. And so we actually call all this extracellular space, since it's so special, the matrix. And connective tissue has a matrix. Epithelium has no matrix. All right, let's look at the kinds of fibers. There can be really thick fibers, really strong. This is the strongest kind of fiber in our body. It's made from a protein called collagen. So I do want you to know that chemical name. Collagen is a strong fiber, and you, if you pull it from end to end, if you grab it here and grab it here and pull, you can't stretch it unless you get into an airplane accident or a bad car accident. Then with that extreme force, these things can rip if you pull it from end to end, but generally it will never be damaged unless you pull it from side to side. If you pull it from side to side, look what can happen. It can tear in the middle. It can form separations. Collagen is strong, can't be damaged, doesn't stretch at all when you pull it from end to end. That's what its job is in your body. Okay, the strongest kind of fiber. And that fiber is made by a certain cell within this connective tissue, and you should know the name of that cell that secretes this fiber into the matrix. And you see it on this slide. And it is called a fibroblast. A fibroblast secretes fibers into the matrix. One of the types of fibers is the strong one called collagen. It can also secrete something a little bit smaller. This one, if you grab it from end to end and pull it, it moves pretty easily. It stretches easily, but that's not the important property. The important property is if you let go of the ends, it snaps back to its original length. What does that sound like? Elastic. And indeed, we call that an elastic fiber made out of elastin. Nonetheless, it's a fiber. It's still secreted by a fibroblast into the matrix. Right? Elastic fibers can be damaged a whole lot more easily. You can overstretch these, and then that fiber is going to be damaged. Won't necessarily repair itself to the original position and strength and orientation. Right, so it's easy to damage elastic fibers. And you might notice that I should Google this. Right, I should Google a boxer who's had his ear punched. Your ear has a lot of elastic fibers, because when you bend your ear and let go, what happens to your ear? It springs back to its original shape. Okay, but if it's been traumatized, those elastic fibers grow back in some weird kind of pattern, and it produces something we call a cauliflower ear, right? So Google cauliflower ear, and I don't know the name of any particular boxer, okay? Okay, hey, wait a second. Class isn't over. 12:05. I have it written down. Okay, it is over. One last thing. The weakest fiber is reticular. So those are the three fibers. Make sure you sign the sign-in sheet. Collagen, the strongest, elastic, weak, but stretchy. Reticular is weak and it doesn't stretch, it doesn't snap back. It's just sort of there in some tissues. All right, so we're going to finish up connective tissue next time.